history, the period from 1800 to 1950 is a period of divergence, growing power of the North Atlantic relative to the rest of the world. It's the period of European imperialism, high imperialism, not the first colonies, but the conquests of large land areas. The period after 1950, broadly speaking, is the period of economic convergence. The basic reason for convergence is sovereignty. The basic reason that sovereignty matters is that this is the beginning of mass education. Pakistan and India in 1950 had illiteracy of 90%. There was no mass education because that's the essence of empire, is do not provide education. And without education, there was no economic possibility other than subjugation. And so independence is fundamental for changing the direction. And that's why the world changes, because that is the end of World War II. And it's the beginning of independence across the world from European empires. And it enabled the beginning of mass education. And the United States, in my view, is the most violent country in the world after 1950. And yet these are supposed liberal democracies. But the basic point is liberal democracy has almost nothing to do with peaceful foreign policy. Foreign policy is about relative power, Britain used its relative power to conquer a large part of the world. And for the parts that it didn't conquer, it at least invaded or went to war at various times. So don't ever make the confusion of liberalism or democracy and peace. These are different concepts.
You're listening to Jeffrey Sachs, Wars of Hegemonic Competition. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So what are the main solutions to wars of plunder? There are two. One, technological convergence. Narrow the gap so that the rich can't exploit the poor. And the second is collective security, to protect the weak from the strong through collective security, such as the United Nations aims to achieve. Now, as I've said, the end of European imperial rule led to a shift from divergence to convergence. And one might have hoped that would end the imperial wars. Of course, there was a trailing edge of 30 years of the final stages of imperialism. For example, the Vietnam War, which raged until 1975, which was a war of independence from France and then taken over by the United States. But by and large, the shift from divergence to convergence reduced the wars of plunder without question. And why the age of convergence? As I've said, independent states introduced education. There was an accelerated diffusion of technology, markets for technology. The spread of digital technologies is nearly ubiquitous, even to some of the poorest places in the world. There have still been wars of plunder, and major powers still defeat weaker nations, but they don't subdue them anymore. Algeria, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria are all examples of mostly the United States, also France, fighting these wars, but failing in the wars of plunder. So technological convergence really does reduce the wars of plunder, but it also leads to more great power conflict, because as countries come together in power, they compete more aggressively for domination. Visions of that, rising powers fear that they'll be held back by incumbent powers. That was Japan's fear in 1941. That was Germany's fear in 1914. That was maybe China's realistic assessment now that the United States is trying to contain China's rise. And so the United States is a deep threat to China's future. Incumbent powers fear they'll be overtaken by rising powers. That's the so-called Thucydides trap. And the wars among the would-be hegemons, the leading powers, are the most destructive. So an example of a rising power through convergence is Germany's economic rise from 1870 to 1914. According to the same data of Angus Madison, that Germany crosses the UK GDP actually around 1905, and war ensues around 1914. Of course, I won't get into all the debates and complexities of World War I, except to say it was a tragedy of great powers. Each of the powers felt extremely vulnerable to the others, and especially Germany, France, UK, and the Habsburg Empire. Well, we're in a similar situation now. According to the International Monetary Fund, China overtook the United States in total output in 2011. These are GDP measured at purchasing power prices, not at market exchange rates. So that's just important as a technical matter. But it means that China is now the larger economy. I say, well, what do you expect? China has four times the population of the United States. Of course, it's going to be a larger economy, except if China remains perennially poor. Technically, if China remains at less than one-fourth the per capita income of the United States. But why should that be? China is enormously productive, creative, innovative, hardworking. The education system is excellent. So why wouldn't China rise in relative economic terms? And of course they have, and now it's a larger power. As Mearsheimer predicted uncannily in 2002, he said this will lead to the onset of hostility. I have to say, he was right. I was certainly wrong, because I've been engaged with China for 40 years now. Many of my students are senior officials in China. Many are academics in China. And I could never imagine that we would have these tensions, because China is not a threat to the world. Only in our newspapers is it a threat to the world. Now our newspapers are hysterically pointing out that it is a threat to the world. By the way, I'm convinced by people who have never been to China, these pundits, so-called. But as China got bigger, per se, China became an enemy. And a couple of days ago, the U.S. Congress held hearings on China's threat. Now, I guarantee those people, they probably don't even have a passport, those congressmen. They know nothing. So I'm just giving you a hint. But Mearsheimer's right. Threat, counter threat, escalation of rhetoric, daily columns about the coming war. And sure enough, you have tragedy. So this is what convergence is bringing. Incidentally, the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are now larger than the G7 countries. This is rather remarkable. To my mind, great, because it means economic convergence taking place. It means a narrowing of the gap. It means that the strange divergence of the industrial era from roughly 1750, I'll say, until 1950, which produced the North Atlantic-led world, is over. Good. Why should the North Atlantic, with 10% of the world population, lead the world? That was obviously an artificial aspect. James Watt came up with a great invention. The North Atlantic developed on the basis of that. I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but the basic idea is that one small part of the world should not morally and ethically dominate the rest. And the mechanics of domination don't exist. But with this convergence comes tension and new forms of war. We have a war in Ukraine. What about if Russia escalates? Well, Russia says, whatever the U.S. does, we should escalate. Both sides escalate. That's Mearsheimer's point, that is the rational action to take if each side is playing for its advantage, taking as given what the other country is doing. So both sides escalate and both sides lose. Of course, Ukraine loses the most. So I don't have this really depicting exactly the Ukraine war, I want to be clear. But the idea is that the U.S. and Russia both escalate. What does this mean in practice? The U.S. pushes NATO enlargement and Russia pushes war to stop NATO enlargement. And you end up with a disaster for both sides. You look at that and say, guys, could you sit down and have a look? This isn't working very well for you. You're stuck in a disaster. Wouldn't it be good for both of you to chill, sit down? Maybe U.S., I have an idea, don't expand NATO. Just stay out. Russia, go home. Let Ukraine live. Stop fighting over Ukraine. If you say, as I do every day, why don't you negotiate? Well, you're called a Putin apologist. You're denied access to the Western media. You're deemed to be a fool and so forth. Frankly, we are in a tragedy. We are in the tragedy of great power politics, and it's getting worse because you end up with continuing escalation. The end of continuing escalation is nuclear war. There's nothing beyond that, but there's nothing that stops the escalation to that. If Ukraine were really to be armed to invade Crimea, well, there would then be nuclear war. You would be told moments before we all are destroyed, don't worry about it. My advice to you is worry about it. But we don't have an international relations theory that is adequate for this. That's what we are searching for. How many times has President Biden spoken with President Putin during the year since the war started? I'll give you a hint. It's less than one. It is zero. So this is not grown up. Five-year-olds would do better. We need to sit down to talk. It's surprising how talking is a human activity that makes a substantive difference in allowing a solution to a social dilemma. The other is a point that Ronald Reagan emphasized. Agreement is not based on trust. It's not based on naivete. It is trust, but verify. Finally, let me turn to the third kind of war, and that is interethnic violence and the social structures of fear. Intercommunal violence is a special kind of war. It is conflict amplified by group identity with very little communication between groups, open hostility, typically long-lasting, very high fear factors on both sides. Both sides are typically prisoners of history. As my wife says, those who can't forget history are condemned to repeat it. The opposite of the usual idea. When you are stuck in intercommunal conflict, if you can't forget the past, that they did this to us, then there is the constant provocation that more will come and that it's impossible to reach peace. There are very few structures of protection for communities, so the fear is very, very high. And we don't have a developed jurisprudence or political structure in most of history about group rights, which we need. So the United States does not have a concept of group rights, for example. In fact, we're now going to probably see the end of so-called affirmative action in the United States because it violates individual rights, will be the Supreme Court's likely decision. We don't have a concept of how in a diverse, multi-ethnic community, different ethnicities can have rights. And those group rights were important. We've lost even the search for group rights in our ideologies of liberalism and in our constitutional designs. And this makes intercommunal conflict more likely and persistent. Fear is a deep driver of this. I don't have time to elaborate, but there are wonderful articles by psychologists, social psychologists, neuroscientists, and conflict resolution specialists emphasizing the role of fear really as a subcortical, fast, reactive kind of decision-making. It's not an emotional act, it's a cognitive act. And fear derails that kind of cognitive act to an important extent. So what are some potential partial answers which nobody has found? I would say first, group rights, especially for minority groups within a political framework. The search for universal ethics, an ethics of tolerance, which is a special kind of ethics, which I'll come to in a moment. Intergroup dialogue, social and political structures of mediation, and shared culture, which is extremely important. Arts, sports, music, literature. I really object to and disagree fundamentally with the call, for example, of excluding Russian athletes from the 2024 Olympics. This is the opposite of what we need to find peace in the world. And the Ukrainian demands to exclude Russian athletes or to stop playing Tchaikovsky or to stop Russian ballets is mind-bogglingly wrong. It's the opposite of what we need for peace. I am a huge believer that ancient wisdom can help us to find solutions, whether it is Confucius or the Buddha or Aristotle or the prophet Isaiah, as imagined by Michelangelo on the Sistine Chapel. There is a commonality of views across the great faiths, and that is vital if we're going to find an end to this kind of conflict. I would argue that there are at least six shared pillars of ancient wisdom across the Greeks, Jewish and Christian traditions, Islamic faith, Buddhism, Hinduism, and other ancient wisdom traditions. First, they're all based on virtue ethics, that the way to well-being is by building our characters, which I think is a fundamental point. It was not the dominant form of ethics in the English and Germanic world in the last three centuries, but it's making a very strong comeback. And I think virtue ethics is the right form of ethics, more than deontological or utilitarian ethics, because it puts ethics as the core of individual responsibility. Second, it emphasizes that humans struggle between lower urges, let's cheat and take advantage, and a higher calling, let's cooperate because that's the right thing to do. It calls on reason of various kinds as being fundamental on the path to reaching that higher calling. It says that we need a vision of perfection, and this is where I think spirituality or religion is fundamental. And that is true from Plato and Aristotle through the various faiths, that God or the first mover or the idea of the ideal form is the sense of perfection and the responsibility of humans to strive for something better. And I think ancient wisdom strongly emphasizes this point, the idea that religion and science are antithetical in some way is actually a modern idea. It is not the idea of ancient wisdom. And fundamentally, that there is a single human family. And I think not only the modern genetics of Homo sapiens proves this, and our knowledge of the single human family in the migration from Africa around 70,000 years ago, but the idea that we can find a common spirit as the basis of our shared humanity, despite our distinctive faiths and cultures, is a shared view of all of these ancient wisdom traditions. We are the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the closest we've ever come as humanity to expressing a common shared ideal. This was brought to fruition by Eleanor Roosevelt, and she was absolutely remarkable and brought together philosophers and theologians leaders from across the world and from all faiths to forge the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it is based on the idea that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. So just to conclude, we have different kinds of conflicts. We need different kinds of remedies. I believe that the United Nations remains indispensable for our survival, even as its fragility is evident in the face of great power politics, private greed, and state impunity. So the world's very difficult. The UN has a very difficult time functioning in a difficult world, but it remains, in my view, our best hope for the universal human family. Let me close with words of President John F. Kennedy. I opened with his words, and I'll close with his words on my favorite speech of his. It was given on June 10, 1963. It was a speech asking the American people to change their attitudes towards the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union are human beings too who want peace. Can you imagine at the height of the Cold War, an American president saying we need to empathize with the other side so that we can forge peace? When he gave this speech, Nikita Khrushchev heard it, called the American envoy in Moscow, Averell Harriman, and said, this is the finest speech by an American president since Franklin Roosevelt. I want to sign a peace agreement with your president. 6 weeks later, the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was signed. This is how to get empathy, humanity, decency, speaking to the other side. So I'll just close with President Kennedy's words from that speech. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and to the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal. Thank you very much.
You were just listening to Jeffrey Sachs, Wars of Hegemonic Competition. He gave the Allama Iqbal lecture at Oxford University in early March. Jeffrey Sachs, Columbia University professor, is an internationally renowned economist. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as John Mearsheimer, Richard Wolff, Medea Benjamin, Arundhati Roy, Noam Chomsky, and Vandana Shiva. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Jeffrey Sachs, Wars of Hegemonic Competition, and for the Howard Zinn classic book, A People's History of the United States, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with the Sabri Brothers of Pakistan, singing an Urdu poem by Allama Iqbal. Oh,